new tools for non-elk beer production. Today we'll go through kind of start to finish with focusing on production process and tools available for producing, and then I'll finish off the conversation with talking about stability options and some new tools available for that, including Negardo, which is kind of brand new on the scene, and I'll focus on all the options, but then we'll do kind of a deep dive on Negardo, the glycolipid for stabilizing beverages, including non-alc beer. My name's Nate Armbrust. I'm with Scott Laboratories. I've been in the beverage industry for like over 25 years now. Most of it on the product and process development side of things. More recently joined Scott Labs on the supply side, and I work primarily in beverage stabilization. Scott Labs, you may not know us. We've been around for coming up on 100 years, but primarily started in the wine industry as a wine industry supplier, but more recently have a presence in all beverage, specialty beverage. So I spend most of my time working on specialty beverage stabilization. We're based in California. I'm out of Portland, Oregon, but we're really into education for sure. Our website's got a ton of good articles on all things beverage, and then honesty and doing the right thing. So I will hand this over to Kyle, and he'll introduce himself and Lalamon, and then go through his portion of the presentation, and then I'll join you again for stability talk.
All right. Hi, everybody. So real quick, I just want to talk a little bit about Lalamon, just in case you're not familiar with us. We are a company based out of Montreal, Canada. We are privately owned. So I work in the brewing division, but we have several divisions. It's actually 12 now. I need to get this slide updated. We just added coffee and chocolate. We started as a baking yeast company, but anything involving yeast, bacteria, active cultures, whether that's pharmaceuticals or distillation, we're involved in a lot of different things. And what's really cool about that is it gives us access to some very interesting technologies and information. And I really like the company I work for. If you're not familiar, I encourage you to look us up. We're doing some cool stuff. Just a little bit about me. So that's a picture of me. This is actually me. My name is Kyle. I'm the technical sales manager. I'm based in Santa Rosa, California. I cover the Western U.S., but I will talk at or to anybody about anything related to beer. So stop by our booth. We got some beers. I'm current president for the Northern California Master Brewers Association. Went through Siebel, but I was also a brewer for a long time. I brewed on everything from homebrew all the way up to 250 barrel brew houses and basically everything in between. So I've brewed a lot of beer. You maybe even had some that I made. So just a quick little outline of what I'm going to be talking about today. I'm mostly going to be talking about kind of the recipe and process considerations. So why consider NA beer production? I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because, frankly, you're all in this room because you understand that this is a growing segment, especially when we're talking about growth within the United States. There's a lot of opportunities for this, and people are a little more health conscious maybe than they were in generations past. And you can see here, these are the potential losses we're having, right, in terms of what we're able to sell to people. And you'll see the 22% prefer NA beer over NA liquor, NA wine, and I think that's because of the technologies we have available to us that allow us to make a better product. So what do consumers miss in a non-alcoholic beverage? Well, there's mood-enhancing effects, which is, of course, the alcohol. There's flavor, variety of choice, and sociability. This is what you control, right? These are the two things that we have the biggest effect on. Sociability, I think that can turn into conversations about front of house, if you're serving on site. I could have easily included that in this, but really what I'm going to focus on right now are just a couple different methods of producing, and then I'm going to get into recipe design and best practices for that. So in terms of production options, there's thermal and evaporative, which historically is what most people were doing. You're using heat to, of course, remove the alcohol from the product. Now, the pros of that is you can have a 0.0% beverage. The downside is you're losing a lot of the flavors that make your beer taste good. And there's also, of course, the capital expenditure cost, which I think a lot of people are very interested in NA beer. They're seeing the growth. They're trying to make the decision, and that can be a big barrier for entry. There are options with semi-permeable membranes, which is going to be reverse osmosis typically. Again, there's going to be losses. There's a high capital expenditure, high water usage. And so those are all things to consider. 0.0 versus 0.5 are going to be the main the difference in terms of pros. Arrested fermentation, so this was, again, a historical option that existed for a long time. So it doesn't require a lot of capital expenditure because you're using equipment that you already have, has minimal to no flavor degradation because you're not using physical means of stripping. The hard part is it's very easy to overshoot your alcohol targets, and when you do that, you're going to be forced to water it back, which has the obvious downside of now your beer tastes like it's watered down. There are some potential concerns for stability, but luckily we have some answers for that, and we'll talk about that more later in the process. But where we've had the biggest changes in the last few years is in limited fermentations by using maltose and maltotriose negative strains. So with the limited fermentations, they're typically using maltotriose negative strains. Usually those are going to be like your English variant stuff. But the nice part now is you already have the equipment in your brewery right now where you can do this. It's just yeast, right? You're just using it in a different way. So I'm going to focus a little bit more on limited fermentation just because I have a yeast background. I work for a yeast company, and that's obviously something we're promoting, but also something I firmly believe has been a big difference maker. You know, there's social changes in terms of popularity with NA beer, but also along with that comes a better tasting product. And the better we can make our product, you know, there's, again, potential for growth and market share and all that fun stuff. But what we're really doing is we're creating something unique, interesting, and it tastes good. And those are the tools that are going to get us there. And so for limited fermentation, you know, there's going to be the non-saccharomyces, there's going to be the pichia, the candida, stuff like that. And they have varying degrees of maltose utilization. They may require special handling. It could require constant aeration, stuff like that. Otherwise, if they change in kind of different pathways, all of a sudden you're overshooting your alcohol targets again. And then historically, we did have some saccharomyces variants as well, like the Chevalieri. They're usually POF positive, which doesn't always meet consumer expectations, right, in terms of what they're looking for. I know in taste panels, those tend to score well in places like Germany, but in the U.S., generally not scoring as well. And so really what I encourage more people to consider and look at are going to be you could look at the maltotriose negative strains, but really the modified maltose negative. And so with maltotriose negative, typically those are our English origin strains. You know, normally when we're using that in the brewing, like regular beer brewing, it's because we want to have like a fuller body and a little more residual sugar and those nice biscuity and caramel and stuff like that. But it can be really hard to keep it within a range that once you've watered back down to the 0.5% alcohol limit in the United States that, you know, it will have a negative effect on the overall perception of the beer. And so the biggest changes have happened really with the modified Saccharomyces, and that's really just been in the last few years. That's not something that existed historically. It can be a little bit of a silver bullet, and some of these are going to be genetically modified. I'm using our examples. We're not the only ones available. I'm obviously just more familiar with our products. And so Lona was what we came up with. It's a very clever name, L-O-N-A, Lona. But it's hybridized, and so it's a non-genetically modified. It's just traditional breeding techniques, and it makes your beer taste like a regular beer because it's just Saccharomyces cerevisiae. We're not going outside of, again, like what the expectations are for your beer to taste like. There are possibility, you know, there's going to be residual sugar in this, so you do have to be more aware of stability concerns, but we have tools for that, and with, like, knowledge and understanding of both why that's important and the tools available at your disposal, it's pretty easy to get past. And so as we see NA beers going into the market and expectations coming up with them, I think that this is going to be a little bit of a game changer. So going to do a little self-promotion in this one, but the rest of the time I'd like to focus a little bit more just on like the educational aspect of it. But Lona, there's some really good beers on the market. We're really lucky that Sierra Nevada Brewing in particular not only uses our yeast, but have publicly said that we're allowed to tell people about that, use it for all five of their beer styles. And so it's a very neutral yeast. So with the rest of your ingredients, you can really design the beer that you want. It's got low pitch rates. There's no contracts required. It's dry yeast. It's shelf stable. It's really easy to work with. It doesn't require any special handling. It's just Saccharomyces cerevisiae that has otherwise very bad attenuation, except this time we're doing it on purpose. For anyone who's not familiar just with hybridization, just to go over kind of real quick what that looks like. So normally when we're using yeast, right, we got our mother-daughter cells. They're cloning each other. There's very little genetic drift. with. What some people don't realize is that you can actually encourage them to share their genetics. We put them in what is a very stressful environment for them, and they're like, hey, if we don't share our genetics, both of our lineages will end. And so they'll actually share in a heterosexual mating, and then we'll select their offspring from there. And so this is just kind of like a very brief explanation of what that looks like, in particular for Lona. So we took a maltose negative strain. We actually bred in with an Italian wine strain that is physically incapable of producing hydrogen sulfide. So as we do all of our hybridizing projects, we actually kind of blend that into all of them just because you never want hydrogen sulfide, right? But we take that and we sporulate and they grow and they shmoo, they share their genetics, and then we sample out for their offspring. And we look for a couple of different traits, and depending on what we're working on is what we'll select for. In this case, we were selecting for an inability to utilize maltose, which is, of course, the main sugar source in your malt. So now we have our maltose negative non-H2S yeast. Let's talk about how to use it. So, let's go back a little bit. Before our fermentation, let's talk about our malt bill, because really this is where all of it starts. You have to make some important decisions, and it is different than regular beer, and you need to keep that in mind. And so, in general, I recommend removing as much or all of the crystal or caramel malts, because it can increase the oxidative character, and that's something I think I certainly saw that trend with West Coast IPAs back in the 2010s, right? It's really important in non-alcoholic beer. And so minimizing or removing your crystal or caramel malts, avoiding highly kiln malts, also factors into the same reason I would encourage you to consider the LOX-less barley. So LOX is lipoxygenase, and that's an enzyme that's present naturally in barley that's going to create trans-2-nonanol and all. And we're seeing more of those on the market. I know there's been some talks about it at this event. I'm not a maltster. I would encourage you to talk to your maltster about them. Normally, it's a conversation about shelf life. Why it's extra important in a non-alcoholic beer is because of the limited fermentation, you're not seeing the same level of aldehyde reduction that you would. And so if you're adding just as many aldehydes, but you're not removing as many of them, typically you're going to have losses during the boil as well as during a fuller fermentation. You need to ideally start with a lower level. And so these aldehydes can present in several different ways, and I can go into, I've got an entire hour-long presentation just on these. But what you're looking at is aldehydes coming mostly from the Maillard reaction, as well as Strecker degradation, which is kind of like a subcategory therein. And so if you're taking the heat load out of your malt bill, you're setting yourself up for success. And so I encourage you throughout your process to consider the amount of heat you're adding, because that's going to increase the level of aldehydes. And when we're talking about the wordy flavors in our beer, typically what we're talking about is aldehydes. So moving past the malt bill, also, of course, using mouthfeel-enhancing malt, foam-positive malt. Again, you're going to have a thinner body. So that's just something that you can encourage, a nice, fuller beer by adjusting your malt profile. So degree fermentation, I think, in general, maybe a little more comfortable having a conversation about the term attenuation. But really what we're talking about is how much of the available sugars are you actually going to ferment? And I'll talk about this a little bit more in another slide. But really with this, you want to start at a low gravity and you end at a low gravity. And when you produce less alcohol, you have to water it down less. Or even if you're doing it in a like really ideal situation, perhaps adding no water cold side at all. And so you're not going to affect that kind of finished body mouthfeel flavor of your beer. So lower gravity allows for a higher degree of fermentation. And again, I'll get in that in about two slides from now. But let's talk about mashing profiles right now. And so with this, since we're trying to create as many long-chain sugars as possible, we're minimizing the amount of glucose and short fermentable sugars that are being created. And the less of those that are there, the less that goes for fermentation. There's a little bit of a balancing act. There's no right-wrong answer with this, but you need to kind of choose your own path. But in general, I recommend going for really what feels like a really high mash temperature. So we're talking like well into the 160s Fahrenheit, like about 70 degrees C, which is 158. You're going to want to be above that. And we're actually trying to minimize conversion. And so this is kind of different than what we're normally looking at. We want as much of that to be maltose and maltotriose as possible. The more simple sugars, the more it ferments, might need to water it back. And so you're going to want to do ideally a low water to grist ratio, because we don't want to encourage enzymatic conversion, and ideally a short hold or no hold at all. And so what I would recommend, really, depending on how your system is set up, once you're done mashing in, immediately start running off. Just immediately go on to that next step. We want to minimize conversion as much as possible. So hot mash, short mash, hot sparge, and minimize that overall conversion. And so here's the sugar profile at 65 versus 70. For the Fahrenheit users, that's 148 and 158 respectively. And you can just see how different that is. And so the dextrins, the high molecular weight, HMW, those aren't going to be fermented. The maltotriose isn't going to be fermented. And the maltose, if you're using a modified yeast, won't be either. And so just keep that in mind, that the same concentration of glucose versus maltose, the glucose, if you had the same concentration, would actually come across as much sweeter. Luckily for us, maltose doesn't come across nearly as perceptibly sweet. And so we're not making a sugar bomb. And you can balance that out in other ways through acidification, carbonation, and other ways of balancing that out. So going back to degrees fermentation, so kind of what we would call the lower end of this would be about 10%, higher would be 25%. Now, we know what our target is at the end of fermentation. You could go for a lower degree of fermentation and not have to worry about watering back at all. But again, it also matters what your original gravity is. About 5 to 8 is kind of the sweet spot for that. I wouldn't recommend going much higher or under. And another thing is, if you're going really low on that starting OG, I would encourage you to use rice hulls just so your day doesn't get too crazy. It can be really easy to collapse your malt bed if it's too thin. So this is kind of the balancing act. And this is where you'll have to make a decision yourself, but I just want you to understand kind of the difference. When you're going for that lower degree of fermentation, right, you're going to have lower alcohol production. Well, that's good. But you might also have a slightly wordier beer because it's going to go through a shorter fermentation. And as we go through that fermentation, not only are we creating the nice esters, the sulfur compounds that make it taste like beer, it's also breaking down some of those aldehydes, which are giving some of the vegetal flavors. And so, again, those are the decisions you'll have to make. The lack of expected desirable compounds, those are the nice esters, the sulfurs. More residual sugar, that comes back to a stability thing. It shouldn't, you know, it's not the end all be all, because hopefully as we go through this, you'll feel confident in your ability to make a stable product. And then no or low dilution required. And so if you go through more of a fermentation, you'll just have to dilute a little bit more. And so you really need to be focused on adding body enhancing malt or process aids available. So this is kind of a fun one. This is a product we make. It's called ISY Enhance. I call it the bodybuilder. It is an inactivated yeast. And so what we've done is we have yeast that will absorb a lot of mannoproteins, oligosaccharides, and polysaccharides, and then we kiln it. It's not going to ferment anything. It is a non-fermentative yeast. It's been kilned. It's dead. But what it does have is very bioavailable mannoproteins, oligosaccharides, polysaccharides, and that gives it body and mouthfeel. It's actually cheaper than maltodextrin, and it works. I must admit, I'm a skeptical person in general, and I was skeptical about how much this would work, but it's amazing how much it helps in side-by-side comparisons. It's really obvious which ones are treated, and it just helps put a little structure on your tongue. You don't need to only use it in non-alcoholic beers. It also works really well in low-alcoholic beers, and it can also help with hop burn as well. So if you have something that's a little on the astringent side, I call it the fine grit sandpaper that kind of just takes all the little edges off of everything and helps prop your beer back up in what's already kind of a thin product. And so it's a problem fixer in a lot of different ways, and it's a newer product, and it's not that expensive. And so I would encourage you to try it out. And after we wrap this up, if you want to come back by our booth, not only do we have some NA beers available, but I also have a little solution of this, and we can do fun side-by-sides and try it out. It's pretty remarkable how well it works. So going on to hops, hot side additions can be used as normal, but dial back your bitterness. Because of the difference in these beers, it's going to come across as much more bitter. If you're doing an existing recipe, take whatever you do as normal, and I dial that back by about 25 to maybe even 50%. And, you know, these products are going to take a little bit more research and development, I think, than your normal beers, just because we're using them in different applications, and we're not going through like that full fermentation. For cold side additions, if you want to make a hoppy beer, load up your whirlpool. I would either minimize or completely remove dry hops, and I would actually encourage you to use a non-pellet option because they're mostly clean but not entirely clean, and now we have an inherently less stable beverage. We're trying to minimize our contact points as much as possible, and that's another possible ingress for bacteria and spoilage organisms, other stuff like that. And luckily, there are a ton of products available to kind of offset that like need for dry hopping. One of them, it's cool. So this is not a product that Lallemand makes, but it is yeast derived, which I think is really interesting. There's a lot of hop derived products. This one in particular is fermentation derived. And so it has more of that kind of natural kind of profile, which I particularly like. I'm very picky when something comes across as artificial. Maybe not the most enjoyable experience. So we also have those. Evodia has their little booth. You can do some testing with them, and I'd encourage you to talk to them. And again, that's not a Lallemand thing, but I do think it's really neat that it's yeast-derived. So kind of trying to look at this from a more holistic point of view. There's a lot of control points, and there's a lot of, again, decisions that you'll have to make in the R&D process, but knowledge is power. And so going into this, you know, you can control your bitterness, and you're going to have to find that balance. Acidity and pH, both from a microbial standpoint, but also balancing against some of that sweetness can really help. We'll get into it in a minute. You should be at least 4.2 pH or lower to inhibit growth, but also that will help offset that. Adding more carbonation will help strip some of those sugars off of your tongue so you don't get that like cloying slickness. I would recommend going about 0.5 to or 0.05 to 0.1 higher carbonation level than you normally would will help with that. And just be mindful of your mouthfeel and body because it's going to be a thin mash that will be noticeable. So use those malts. Use that ISY Enhance. Keep in mind that you're going to need to just work a little bit harder to get that same level of perception. And just think about degree of fermentation. Again, that's a decision you'll have to make, but it is a tool in order to help craft the beer that you really want to. The amount of fermentable sugars, right, is going to be out of, you know, going to dictate your degree of fermentation. But ultimately, like with all things, it comes down to balance. You're going to have to balance your residual sugars. You're going to have to balance your body and mouthfeel. You'll have to make those decisions. So I'm going to kind of start leading into the stability side before handing off to Nate. This is something I feel very strongly about. If you're going to make any beer, I want you to take this seriously. It is not an inherently stable product in the same way that beer is. We're a largely unregulated industry because there are nothing outside of really spoilage organisms that can survive in your beer. But that changes when we're talking about non-alcoholic beer. And it's important to know. A lot of us do not come from a food science background. I know some of us do. But let's just talk about it for a minute to understand that, again, we're moving past spoilage organisms and we actually need to have a conversation about pathogens. There's a potential to make someone very sick, which is obviously very bad. You could lose your business. You could have long-lasting impacts on how we are regulated as an industry, and there are tools. So don't skip this step. Recipe design is fun. I enjoy it. It's interesting, but let's focus on this too. And so let's just talk about bacteria real quick. Listeria and botulism are actually largely a non-issue. If you do make non-beer drinks in your facility, keep in mind that listeria is cold tolerant and can be a concern, but luckily for us, hops are antimicrobial. And so they take care of the gram-positive bacteria for you. So if you're making a beverage without hops, I encourage you to do some reading and just understand that the risks with that. But really for us, we're talking about gram-negative bacteria. E. coli and Salmonella are the most common forms of food poisoning in the United States. And you're talking more about a food product than you are a regular beer at this point, right? So contamination can come from a lot of places. Typically, it's coming from your raw materials. I think we've probably all found some weird stuff in our grain before. We have our kill step at the beginning, unlike something like wine or cider where you're able to add your sulfites at the end. With beer, we go through the boil, but some of that stuff is still going to be in your air. It's going to be in the air. It's going to be in the ambient. It's going to be on surfaces. So that's where the equipment and packaging comes from. Poor worker hygiene is a possibility as well. If you're sick or if someone is working, is not feeling well, please do not let them touch your things. Send them home. Make them drink some Gatorade. Let them sleep it off. But those are kind of your kind of points of ingress that you need to be aware of. But most likely it's probably going to come from raw materials. And so E. coli and Salmonella, it's not that they just survive in these beverages, it's that they're able to grow. And You know, especially when it's stored at warm temperatures, it can affect how fast it's able to grow. And so there's these really nice studies from Menz et al. In 2011. They've got these great graphs. Rashawn also has a nice presentation. These are all cited source studies. And I just want to highlight here, so the circle, that's 0.5 ABV, 2.7, and 5% if you can't read that. And so at the higher ABV, and this is a pretty high level of bacterial contamination, and it's at a level that's unlikely to happen naturally, but this is just kind of to prove a point. So even at a 5% beer, lasts until over 30 days. Now, it's unlikely that you'd have that level of contamination in the first place, but just to go to show, goes to show that it can survive for extended periods of time. But 0.5% is our legal limit. It actually starts growing. As it adapts to its own environment, by about that second week, it takes off like a rocket. And so you are now making a very unstable beverage. This is E. coli on the left and Salmonella on the right. And so, again, I just want you to keep in mind that without that lack of ethanol, it's not going to protect your beer for you. You're going to have to take additional steps to ensure you're keeping people safe. Here's the effective pH. Again, I said is a minimum about 4.2. So for this example, right, we have 4.3, which is as is. This was an unmodified one, 4.5, which is not at all unreasonable, and a 5 Plato, or a Plato pH. So you can see how much this is growing, and this is in a low-alcohol beer. And so it's just important to understand it's not just going to survive for a little while, it's going to continue to grow. And so I'm just showing this as a to make a point that this is serious, and although it's a low risk, it's not no risk. And again, there are potential long-lasting ramifications of that. You could lose your business and really affect everyone. So and then this is just a quick one. It's looking at effects of temperature. So that's Listeria. That's our hops doing a lot of work for us. Thank you, hops. But you could just see how long it takes for that, even at full strength beer, how long it takes for those to die off. So please take it seriously and look up the studies. It's really interesting because, again, we've kind of moved beyond beer, and now we're getting into to food and food safety. So I'm going to hand this off to Nate. We'll, of course, take some questions at the end, but please stop by our booth afterwards. I'll pour you some NA beer, and we can talk about ISY Enhanced some more.
All right. Thank you, Kyle. Yeah, I'll jump into the stability side, and I'm glad Kyle hit on some of the food safety considerations. It is really, really important, and it should be top of mind for everybody. I mean, food quality is great, but food safety trumps everything. So you just want to make sure you're asking yourself the right questions as you move forward in producing these beers. So we'll talk now stabilization, just three sections, purpose, why it's important, methods of stabilization, some of the tools that are available to us right now, and then kind of considering what's available and how to kind of piece all that together and make a product that's food safe and protected from spoilage organisms as well. So purpose, you know, this kind of just reiterates what Kyle said. You know, as we move away from producing traditional beer that is, you know, inherently stable with a level of alcohol, we need to keep in mind food safety and food quality throughout shelf life. So again, first we must ensure that the product that we produce is free of pathogens. Right? We gotta take care of that first, and then look at food quality on step two, which would be to prevent spoilage organisms. And really, the number one spoilage organism of concern in NA beer is Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Right? I mean, we just want to prevent our finished package, whether it's a bottle or a can or a keg, from you know, our non-alc beer becoming alc beer, you know, very quickly, which can happen very, very quickly. So some of the process controls that we have available, you know, in addition to standard methods of stabilization, things we can do in the brew house, upstream of packaging, to set us up for success. One, sanitation. I mean, sanitation is really important for food safety and food quality, to minimize the risk of secondary contamination. And then pH control is absolutely critical. It's really important. I mean, very simply put, pH 4.2 and below is going to be your friend. The lower, the better. We see pH not as not used to to kill off micro to as a control step for pathogens, but really to mitigate growth, right? So pH is one hurdle that we're going to rely on for stabilization of our product, in addition to, you know, hopefully many, many hurdles, right? The multi-hurdle approach is the ideal. If pathogens are new to you, if you haven't thought about them before, it's really important to kind of understand the world that you're venturing into, because non-alc beers bear a pathogen risk that alcohol beverages do not. The number one thing, if you're not quite sure how to approach it, process authorities are not something that a lot of brewers have probably relied on in the past, but with non-alc beer being a food product, utilizing process authorities is recommended. And what they are, they're a liaison between you and the government. Ultimately, like very common in high acid beverage production on the non-alc side, again, probably not as well known in the beer side, but what they can do is look at your product and your process and identify if it is, you know, if you follow those process steps and your beverage specs are what they are, this is a safe product. Or they'll look at it and say, you know, you need to cover this or that to make a safe product. So they're widely available. There are hundreds across the country. There are good resources for finding one. You don't have to work with one in your state. We can even make some recommendations. We don't work directly with any, but finding the right process authority is highly recommended. And they can essentially write a schedule for you that you follow for your product to make sure that it's food safe. Now we'll go into methods of stabilization. These are, kind of what we have available to us in general. Filtration, tunnel pasteurization, batch pasteurization, flash pasteurizer, or HTST, high temperature, short time, which I'm going to spend some time talking about that. Chemical preservatives, which some folks are using, and then Nagardo as a new tool for preventing spoilage in non-alc beer. And I have filtration labeled as solid separation. This isn't going to be the end of the road for anyone. I don't think anybody in general is going to rely on filtration alone to stabilize their product. It can be a good first step to as a hurdle, right, to set up your flash pasteurizer or somewhere downstream those processes, but they can be really good for bulk removal of yeast and micro. Not necessarily, they're great for yeast in general. Some of them are not so great for bacterial removal, so you can't rely on a centrifuge to spin out all your pathogenic or spoilage bacteria, but it can be a really good step upstream of, say, a flash pasteurizer or so. So I'm going to kind of gloss through these. I guess we didn't really mention, but we have a lot of slides, and I'm going to kind of cruise through them. We'll make this available to anybody who wants it after the presentation, so you don't need to memorize anything about this tunnel pasteurizer or things forward. But so if you have a tunnel pasteurizer, congratulations. That's a wonderful tool for checking off food safety and food quality. Been around for a long time. Heat works in all regards. So very, very good tool for in-container pasteurization of bottles and cans. Some of the downsides, obviously large capital investment, huge footprint in most cases, high energy demand, possible sensory impact. There's certainly going to be some sort of sensory impact to heat applied to the product. And ideally, it's acceptable at the end of the day if you achieve your stability goals. But certainly, there's a sensory impact there. And then what's really critical, especially for beers and other carbonated products, is it really limits the amount of CO2 you can have in your product. If you send a high-carb product through a tunnel, even at low pasteurization temps, you risk bulging cans, bursting cans, things like that. So you really, there's not a hard rule on what your max CO2 volumes are, but most co-packers I've talked with, 2.2 volumes or less feels safe. I know some people are able to push it a little bit higher, but it really limits your upper limit. Basically, batch pasteurizers are the exact same as tunnel. It just cripples your production schedule is all. So I don't know if we've got anybody in here. They're really great tools for proof of concept and for small production, but it really is always going to be somebody's kind of choke point in production. And it's got the same other downsides to a tunnel, which is, sensory impact and then the same CO2 limitations as well. But they're quite interesting. There's a lot of DIY versions of them out there, but a tough way to grow a brand. Flash pasteurization, or HTST, great tool, and we see them in a lot more breweries than we did 15, 20 years ago. So they're used on beer, obviously, but as a lot of breweries are moving towards a co-pack model or expanding the product categories that they're offering, a flash pasteurizer is a great tool. It addresses food safety concerns, right? It is able to get that log reduction, kill step for potential pathogens, which is fantastic. It's got a small footprint. It's better on quality than in-container pasteurization, a tunnel, because you're able to achieve your pasteurization temps more quickly and then cool it back down more quickly. So in general, a little better on the product. And it can be separated from the packaging process. So whereas a tunnel has to be kind of sized for your filler, so everything flows in line, a flash pasteurizer can be its own separate process, flashing into a clean, bright tank and then filling out of that tank. So you're able to kind of disconnect those, which can be helpful. That means you don't have to have a flash pasteurizer that's the same flow rate as your filler necessarily. Downsides, there's some heat there, so possible sensory impact to your product. And the big one, really important one, is that it, on its own, probably not great for food safety and food quality, because as soon as that product leaves your flash pasteurizer, you're at risk of secondary contamination. And so you want to have something else in place downstream of that to protect your product. Like if you have fermentable sugars in there, whether it's a back sweetened product or a maltose negative produced, non-alc beer, it's at real risk of micro pickup during the filling process. And the flash pasteurizer, unfortunately, is no longer on scene to help that out. So persistent preservatives, some of these, would seem kind of silly to use in I don't know of anybody putting sulfur in their beers. Maybe it's happened. I don't know. But probably not something you want to do, but some of the other chemical preservatives, potassium sorbate, benzoates, things like that, they're great because they're inexpensive. They inhibit micro growth, easy to add to the product. Downside is, it's only inhibiting micro. It's not necessarily killing micro. Requires labeling in most cases. There can certainly be some consumer or retailer pushback to some of those chemical preservatives. A lot of people are trying to move away from those, even though they can be quite effective. And certainly there can be a sensory impact to using those. Okay, now into the Negardo side of things. I kind of want to focus on this. This is it's a brand new product. We are really excited about it, especially in a lot of the alcohol space, but specifically in non-alc beer in package and draft. Obviously, non-alc beer are very sensitive to micro spoilage. Negardo is here. It's a natural alternative. You can kind of look at it as a natural alternative to chemical preservatives, but it's doing many different things in different ways. And obviously the risk of not doing anything, if you were just relying on, say, a flash pasteurizer, you got the opportunity for alcohol generation, CO2 generation, sensory defects. Negardo is relevant for all packaging, but kegs are, especially sensitive to spoilage once put on draft. And this is, we want to be really careful about how we talk about this, because Negardo on its own is not a silver bullet. It's not a replacement for a tunnel pasteurizer. It's there to prevent re-fermentation, which it does a really, really nice job of, and we've got a lot of data to support that. So a risk in keg, if you attach it to a draft line that may not be as clean as we would like it to be, is if there's any yeast in there, that you now have yeast in your keg, right? And it can turn into a keg of low alcohol beer pretty quickly. So Negardo is very effective against that. But on its own, the beer that's in that keg needs to have been you know, the pathogen concern has to be considered upstream of that. So typically, I'll kind of get to this at the end, but we recommend flash pasteurization plus Negardo with a low pH in mind to approach non-alc beer as being a food safe thing to distribute. So we'll talk a little bit more of that in a second. Negardo is a it's a glycolipid, so there are other products out there that are mushroom derived that have different modes of action. They're produced differently, different use rates. Negardo is pretty unique in that it's derived from an edible mushroom. It is a glycolipid, which is a fatty acid with a sugar head, hydrophilic head, hydrophobic tail. Again, it's from this source. The source organism is this sweet osmanthus ear, this mushroom here, and it is produced through fermentation. So we don't have hoop houses out growing sweet osmanthus ear, but we have a seed culture that is put in a fermentation vessel with the correct substrate and given the optimal conditions for that seed culture to grow and produce a critical mass of glycolipid. That glycolipid is, I'll kind of jump into it here. So it gets to a critical mass. The mycelium is then separated, and the liquid phase that remains is full of pure glycolipid. It's spray dried, and now what you have is this pure glycolipid. So there's no chemical modifications. It's non-GMO. It's produced with many food safety certifications. It's natural, as you know. I don't like that word usually because there's not a great standard of identity, but it is, you know, produced from a mushroom. It's vegan, kosher, halal, nice product, and it's sold in 15 gram sachets, 2.5 kg pails, and 10 kg pails. The mode of action. So again, this fatty acid attaches to the cell wall. It penetrates that cell wall, that cell lyses, and it is no longer viable. It happens quite rapidly once you add Negardo to the product. The one thing that we want to be really clear about is it's broad-spectrum antimicrobial. It is highly effective against yeast. It's great against a lot of bacteria. It is not effective against gram-negative enterobacter, which includes E. coli. So that's why we kind of continue to want to remind people that this is used for quality, and it's going to be part of a multi hurdle approach to achieve food safety and food quality. It can be used with other preservatives as well. You can, if you for whatever reason want to continue using sorbates and things like that, you can use Negardo with other methods of preservation. This is a study that was done on clarified apple juice showing the dose rates of Negardo that are needed to control specific spoilage micro. And so you can see Saccharomyces cerevisiae, 3.1 ppm of Negardo is enough to prevent fermentation from happening. So super low dose rates to achieve quality spoilage organism kill. Some of the other organisms here, you know, take a slightly higher dose. Most dose rates, we have a lot of information on dose rates for non-alc beer. It's been used in Europe for a couple of years, so we've got good history there. If you come to me with a non-alc, you know, style A or style B, we can direct you on what the right dose rate for Negardo is going to be. If you have another beverage that we haven't really heard of, we might need to do some benchtop stability testing. But in general, for non-alc beer, we're talking dose rates of 12 to 15 ppm normally, maybe up to 20 ppm for larger non-alc beers, but highly, highly effective. So draft, and we, as Kyle mentioned, we've got a non-alc draft on tap at our booth, which we'd love you to come try. I know we're running out of time on the show, but we've got it there. It's quite nice. It was produced by Pilot Project Brewing up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Went up there a couple weeks ago and produced that product. Learned a lot and came away with some really good results. But again, the big risk of non-alc beer is spoilage after you connect it to the tap, right? So Negardo is persistent. It's also heat stable. I didn't mention that before, so you can flash pasteurize it. You could, if you wanted to approach it with in combination with tunnel pasteurization to maybe lower PUs through a tunnel, that's a possibility. We've got people looking at that. But the real risk is you hook up a non-alk keg and it spoils rapidly. So Negardo's there to protect the product, not only in the draft line, but in the keg as well. And again, really important that that keg has been stabilized from a food safety standpoint prior to with flash pasteurization and pH control. But we really think that this is going to open up non-alk draft in the U.S. They've been testing and have had great success in Europe with it already. So as I've mentioned, you know, the multi-hurdle approach is really important. The more hurdles, the higher the hurdles, the better. A process that we've seen be successful, and the way that pilot project beer was produced was through fermentation, rapid fermentation with the maltose negative yeast, right? Like less than 2 days in general, or on this product anyway. Cold crash goes through a centrifuge to remove the bulk yeast load, then goes through flash pasteurization to kill, you know, anything of concern. Into a bright tank, Negardo is added at 15 parts per million on that product, and then to package, whether it's keg or bottle. So you've addressed food safety, food quality, and that the pH on that beer, I believe, is 4.1. So, again, very, very important. But it's like I said, it's persistent, so avoiding, you know, potential contamination downstream, whether it's in keg or in tank. Now, I think it opens up the opportunity to, because once you produce a non-alk beer, the clock's ticking until you get that thing stabilized in a package. If you were to add Negardo in tank, maybe even upstream of flash pasteurization, you now can sleep a little better, knowing that your alcohol is not going to continue to skyrocket there. So a lot of interesting kind of use cases there. Ability to, you know, increase distribution, new market opportunities, and then really kind of being there to protect against secondary contamination. But pre-treatment of non-alk beer is essential for Negardo to protect against secondary contamination. I've talked with a lot of people this week about, that maybe they don't even, it's a small brewery, that maybe they don't even have filtration, and they want to use Negardo to stabilize their NA beer. That's probably not the ideal setup. We really want to have steps upstream to address gram-negative pathogen. So in general, that's HTST or filtration plus HTST is recommended, because even after a centrifuge, there's quite, your beer may be where you need it to be from a sensory standpoint and bulk reduction of micro, but there's still quite a bit of micro in there, so we want to have a step after that. Continue on here. I want to make sure we've got time for questions as well. This is one thing that I definitely want to mention, and we've seen with every trial we've done, is Negardo. It's a glycolipid. It has an immediate and dramatic effect on foam stability, which is not ideal, but it can easily be accounted for with the addition of, you know, some changes in the brew house with some higher protein malts, but really what we've seen success with is the addition of Tetra at the packaging step. So, for instance, that beer that we made at Pilot Project, it was we had 16 barrels in tank. We did a foam stability test off tank. It was great. Added 15 ppm Negardo, foam stability test, head was completely gone. Added 3 ppm Tetra, foam is back. So it's very easily accounted for, but it's something you absolutely need to account for. You can see some of this data here is outlining that. And actually, my reasoning for adding 3 ppm into that beer was because of that chart right there. And it worked out great, but very easy to play around with on bench as well. Wow. So that's a lot of options. We want to put it all together. In thinking about all those options, this slide is a very simple way to kind of think about it. For non-alk beer, you want to check both sides. You want to check food quality, food safety. What are each of these methods going to achieve? Tunnel pasteurizer, check, check. Flash pasteurizer, great on the food safety, not on the food quality, because you have a real risk, and a very real risk of micro pickup during packaging. Probably not. It's probably going to be spoilage organisms. It's not likely to occur that you're going to be picking up pathogens between the bright and the filler, but definitely options for picking up yeast and other spoilage. Persistent preservatives, good on quality, not necessarily going to be used for food safety. Nagardo, same thing, quality, not to be used for food safety. But then you start to combine some of these methods, you know, flash pasteurization plus persistent preservatives or flash plus Nagardo gets you to a spot where you can begin to look at shelf stability in your package by applying these multiple hurdles.